This is Party on the Peninsulas, your weekly update on the people and policies leading Michigan, with Michigan Democratic Party Chair Lavora Barnes.
This fight is about freedom, and the freedom that is fundamental to the promise of America. In America, freedom is not to be given. It is not to be bestowed. It is ours by right.
Yes.
And that includes the freedom to make decisions about one's own body and not have the government telling people what to do. And then just this week, here in Arizona, they have turned back the clock to the 1800s to take away a woman's most fundamental right, the right to make decisions about her own body. Former President Donald Trump did this. Yeah. Donald Trump is the architect of this healthcare crisis.
Yes, he is.
And that is not a fact, by the way, that he hides. Yeah. In fact, he brags about it.
Welcome back to Party on the Peninsulas. I'm Lavora Barnes. The word this week, whatever. That's Donald Trump's position on reproductive health care. He's for whatever is convenient at the time he's asked about it. Here's Trump on Meet the Press in 1999.
I'm very pro-choice. I hate the concept of abortion. I hate it. I hate everything it stands for. I cringe when I listen to people debating the subject. But you still, I just believe in choice. And again, it may be a little bit of a New York background because there is some different attitude in different parts of the country. And, you know, I was raised in New York and grew up and work and everything else in New York City. But I am strongly for choice, and yet I hate the concept of abortion.
But you would not ban it?
No.
Or ban partial birth abortion?
No, I would. I am pro-choice in every respect, and as far as it goes.
Well, he's changed that position almost as regularly as he's changed wives. For decades, Donald Trump's stance on abortion has been a moving target. In 2011, while considering a White House run, he told CPAC that he was pro-life. In 2016, while running for president, he told MSNBC's Chris Matthews that there should be, quote, some form of punishment for the women who get abortions. In 2018, he vowed to overturn Roe v. Wade and advocated for a 20-week national abortion ban. His latest position? A wishy-washy whatever. Of course, he can't run away from a fact that he brags about.
I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and in fact demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade. They wanted it ended. My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
One day later, he pivoted again, coming out against the decision in Arizona to ban virtually all abortions. So much for letting the states decide. We all know what Donald Trump says doesn't necessarily line up with what he will do. You can be certain that a Trump administration, given the chance, would put in place a national law similar to the law just upheld in Arizona, criminalizing abortion and making it illegal nationwide. That would wipe out Michigan's constitutional guarantee, approved overwhelmingly by our voters, that women make their own health care decisions without the government's interference. While Trump says he wouldn't sign a national abortion ban, he hasn't said how he will vote on the Florida constitutional amendment which would protect women's reproductive freedom. Chances are he will dodge that question from now until November. And if, God forbid, he's elected and sent a nationwide ban, he will sign it. As Rachel Maddow put it so concisely, watch what they do, not what they say. Your Democratic Party has made a commitment to reach out to all of Michigan. While Republicans cater to their extremist MAGA wing, Democrats are working in all 83 counties to show we're working on behalf of everyone in this state. The facts backing that effort are undeniable. Since achieving the trifecta in state government, Democrats have moved the state forward on issues ranging from fixing the roads, strengthening the union rights of workers, expanding voter rights, guaranteeing the reproductive health care rights of women, cutting taxes for families, fighting climate change, and much, much more. But historically, we've fallen short when it comes to elections in smaller counties. Over the weekend, our rural summit focused on how we can earn the support of more voters in rural Michigan. Helping us define that strategy was one of the nation's best pollsters, Celinda Lake. In a moment, we'll review with Celinda her advice on how to win back rural Michigan. But first, an update on some of the week's political and policy news from MDP's Dorian Tyus.
In the news this week, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson has fired back at former President Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson for their claims that there were potentially hundreds of thousands of votes being cast by non-citizens, something that is a felony. Benson, a former professor who taught election law, said in a statement that when former President Trump, Speaker Johnson, and others call for states to do things we are already doing or ban things that are already banned, they aren't actually supporting election integrity. They are intentionally misleading American voters. Why? Because they want to scare us. They want to diminish citizens' confidence in valid election results so that they can try to block those valid election results if they don't like them. The lie from Trump and Johnson echoes a fundraising robocall from the Republican National Committee claimed widespread voter fraud in 2020, continuing the big lie that has been knocked down in more than 60 court cases nationwide. A federal judge on Wednesday dismissed efforts by conservative state lawmakers to invalidate voter-initiated changes to Michigan election laws, leaving absentee balloting and early voting rules in place for the fall presidential contest. Republican lawmakers who brought the suit are planning an appeal, however. Last fall, a group of 11 Michigan lawmakers, led by Republican State Senator Jonathan Lindsay, sued Governor Gretchen Whitmer and state election officials, arguing that Proposal 3 of 2018 and Proposal 2 of 2022 should be invalidated because only the legislature should be able to regulate the times, places, and manner of federal elections. President Biden canceled $7.4 billion in student loan debt on Friday. The latest round of relief is part of a strategy by the White House to take smaller, targeted actions for certain subsets of borrowers after the Supreme Court struck down a far more ambitious plan to wipe out $400 billion in debt last year. Biden said this week that he would make another attempt at large-scale debt forgiveness for about 30 million people, despite Republican opposition and legal challenges. But in the meantime, he has been chipping away at student debt by fixing and streamlining existing programs that have been plagued by bureaucratic and other problems for years. Former President Trump attacked Governor Whitmer's program to provide up to $500 a month in temporary rental subsidies to help house immigrants and refugees, falsely claiming it's available to anyone who accepts illegal aliens into their homes, and again suggesting without evidence that many immigrants are terrorists or came to the U.S. from mental institutions or prisons. Trump's comments, which he aired in a 2-minute, 43-second tirade on the Truth Social platform he founded, echoed many of the false or exaggerated claims he made during a campaign trip to Grand Rapids earlier this month. Not surprisingly, it's a lie. The Office of Global Michigan, which administers the newcomer rental subsidy program, said that the subsidies, which are limited to between $300 and $500 a month and can last no longer than 12 months, are not available to anyone considered to be in the country illegally, or immigrants caught attempting to enter the country without documentation and filing what are known as defensive asylum claims to delay removal. They are designed to help Michigan farmers attract migrant workers during crop season. A new Reuters Ipsos poll shows President Biden 4 points up over Trump ahead of the November election. Some 41% of the 833 registered voters in a nationwide survey online said they would vote for Biden if the election were held today, compared with 37% for Trump. That 4-point lead was up from a 1-point lead Biden held in a Reuters Ipsos poll in March. The poll also showed that many voters remain on the fence, with some 22% of registered voters in the poll saying they had either not picked a candidate, were leaning toward third-party options, or might not vote at all. The Biden administration on Thursday announced that it is moving to close the so-called gun show loophole, in which people selling guns online, at shows, and other informal venues have been able to do so without conducting background checks on their customers. The Justice Department said it has submitted a final rule to the Federal Register that will clarify what it means to be engaged in the business of selling guns, meaning those who aren't operating at brick-and-mortar stores will need to obtain federal licenses and perform background checks. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency issued new drinking water standards during the week, directing public utilities to ensure the level of PFAS remains at a safe level for communities. The rule is the first national clean drinking water standard for PFAS, per the agency. Michigan, under Attorney General Dana Nessel, has been a national leader in fighting to ban the so-called forever chemicals from drinking water. As a result of Michigan's proactive efforts to protect drinking water supplies, all of Michigan's public water suppliers have been sampling for PFAS for years and maintaining compliance with state PFAS standards. Nessel is currently defending Michigan's drinking water standards in court against a legal challenge brought by 3M, a major PFAS manufacturer, against the rules establishing these standards. Links to these and other stories are on our website, partyonthepeninsulas.com. From Michigan Democratic Party headquarters in Lansing, I'm Dorian Tyus.
This weekend, Democrats from across Michigan focused on expanding Democratic support in rural Michigan at the annual Rural Summit. In addition to hearing from U.S. Senate Agriculture Chair Debbie Stabenow and Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, they were joined by pollster Celinda Lake, who is part of the Biden-Harris campaign strategy team. Celinda joins us on the podcast this week and shares the top lines of her presentation, as well as her thoughts on the presidential race with our Walt Sword.
Celinda Lake, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on the podcast. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, and thank you so much.
You have talked now with Michigan Democrats about something that's really a challenge for Democrats across the nation, and that is relating to rural voters. The results in rural areas across the nation haven't been very good in recent years. What advice are you able to offer through the polling you've done?
We offered three different pieces of advice. One is to start local, and I come from actually rural Montana, so I can really relate to rural America. I grew up on a ranch in Montana. And starting local is very important, with local messengers, local messages, and local imagery. And do grassroots organizing. The second piece of advice was around social pressure. Yes, we have been losing votes pretty dramatically in rural areas, but we have also, the amount of Republican and Trump support is overstated. And we found in a lot of areas that were even on party, people thought they were outnumbered. Democrats thought they were outnumbered 2-1. So, of course, they kept their heads down low. They kept quiet. They didn't pass things on. And to understand the value of social pressure and social legitimacy so that people feel comfortable passing on information. The third thing we said was to enter through issues and issue conversation, particularly populist economics, and that there are lots of issues that are very powerful in rural America. Commitment to good public education for every child, American ownership of our lands and our farms and small family farms and ranches, support for small business, support for Social Security and Medicare, support for rural hospitals, support for mental health help in rural hospitals. When we enter in through issues, support for our veterans, we have a lot of powerful things to say to rural America.
Is climate change on that list as well?
Not as climate change, but definitely in terms of weather change and extreme weather, and rural America are very aware of that. They're aware of temperature changes and the changes in the crops that they're able to grow and the pests that are now apparent. So yes, and rural America pretty committed to renewable energy as both jobs and an energy, affordable energy source. So not as climate change per se, which can often be politically polarizing, but in terms of the underlying dynamics of the issue, absolutely.
One thing I heard in an interview on another podcast earlier this week, I think it was Pod Save America, with Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, was simply showing up and letting Democrats in rural areas know that we know they're there encourages the turnout of the vote. And even if you're going to lose in that county, you lose better, as Alyssa Slotkin would say.
I think that's exactly right. And showing up and not just doing a flyby or a flyover, but showing up and really talking in community and showing up at the county fair, showing up at the basketball finals, showing up at the church, the local church, and the fish supper, the chicken supper, whatever the church has. So absolutely showing up at the Cinco de Mayo celebration. So there is a lot going on in rural America, and showing up is a big part of the equation. And not just showing up 2 weeks before the election, but showing up all year round.
Let's move to the presidential race nationally, as you're seeing it, as a part of the think tank on the Biden campaign. The polling seems to be slowly getting better and better week after week for Joe Biden. Is that a statistical anomaly, or do you in fact think that he is slowly recovering from the deficit that he was encountering earlier?
I think it's definitely getting better, and it's getting better for a number of reasons. First of all, the State of the Union was a real turning point, and it really energized Democrats. And before that, the Trump voters had been more energized than the Democrats had been. And Democrats are now settling down and realizing this is our ticket, Biden-Harris, and we should be proud of the accomplishments of that ticket. Secondly, the administration, I think, has really caught their stride on message and is articulating very clearly a clear contrast. Contrast messaging is more powerful because you get more credit for what you're for. It doesn't just seem like an empty rhetoric or empty victory tour. And you draw a clear distinction about the future with your opponent. And clearly, that distinction is very vivid against Donald Trump. And I think the economy, bits and starts, is getting better. And the direction of the economy is getting better. And we are doing a better job of articulating and delivering on kitchen table economics.
You talk the positive message, but of course, the negative message is always very effective in campaigns. Donald Trump is so target rich when it comes to things you can go after. What does your polling show is his biggest vulnerability?
His vulnerability is his style and character and the idea that it's so divisive. And of course, in rural America, you have to work together. I wrote a book with a Republican pollster, Ed Goaz, called It's a Question of Respect. But in there, we talked about our mutual childhood. He grew up in the military. I grew up on a ranch. I was a Republican turned Democrat. He was a Democrat turned Republican. And we talk about the fact that in rural America, you have to work together. I remember one time that was vivid in my childhood where my dad at the kitchen table said, well, we're going to mend fence together with the Miles's today, and I need your kids involved in it. And I, of course, little pipsqueak that I was, I said, well, Dad, I thought we didn't like the Miles's. And he goes, well, number one, you call them Mr. Miles and Mrs. Miles. Number two, we never say that. And number three, it doesn't matter whether we like each other or not. We share a fence line and we have to work together. And that's a classic, I think, rural dynamic. So respect for each other and getting along and working together. That is not Donald Trump. He does not respect anybody. He is divisive. A lot of people think that he is on the verge of causing civil war in the country. And so his biggest vulnerability is his style. His style of leadership. His second big vulnerability is all these court cases. And a significant number of Republican voters say that they would be significantly less likely to vote for him if he is convicted of a crime. And he's got 91 cases up against him, 91 charges up against him. And of course, one just about to come online that is very serious in the voters' minds, fraud and bribery to cover up his weaknesses so that he could influence the election. And voters do not take that lightly. So I think those are his biggest flaws. The third thing that we need to do is we need to compete with him on the economy. Right now, Trump has a big advantage over Biden. Democrats are at a disadvantage compared to Republicans, and we need to be competitive on the economy. We found that when we're talking about who's better for the economic well-being of you and your family, the Democrats and Biden rise in that equation. When we're talking about who's better for the economy, Republicans tend to have an advantage, and Trump has an advantage as a businessman. So we have to compete on the economy.
You mentioned the many Trump trials, and of course, there's a possibility that the least significant of the four felony trials is going to be the only one that he faces before the election. What do you see as the impact if he manages to get a hung jury? What he got with the U.S. Senate on impeachment? He had a majority, bipartisan majority of the Senate vote to convict him, but it wasn't the 2/3. It only takes one person in New York City to give him a hung jury. What would that mean for the election?
I think that Joe Biden is even or beating Donald Trump now, and that's before a conviction. So I don't think it'll change. It'll just remain a very close race. I think the voters also, these trials are very public, and the voters know a lot about them. And so I think that this will be tried in the court of public opinion, as well as in the court of New York. And I think voters, when they are faced with the facts, they will irrefutably conclude this was fraud and bribery, and it was trying to influence our elections, and that's wrong.
What's your opinion on Florida, given that we're going to have referenda both on abortion and legalized marijuana in Florida, a state that has been relatively close if you don't count the DeSantis re-election over the years? Is Florida really in play?
I think the problem with Florida is it's a very expensive state. And it's like saying, are we going to play in Western Europe? Because there are so many different Floridas. There's Miami, there's Jacksonville, there's just so many different Floridas. Tallahassee, Orlando. So I think the problem is it takes a lot of resources to compete. I think it'll definitely be more competitive. But I think it's also hard because DeSantis is still governor. And we know that governors make a difference in a state. So I think it'll be the last of the competitive. I think people will keep their eye on it. But I think in the end, resources will have to be concentrated in the seven major swing states.
One last area that I was curious about based on your research, and that is third-party candidates. This isn't your first rodeo. You've seen third-party candidates before, going back to Ralph Nader in 2000, who may well have cost Al Gore the White House. What is your thought right now on the significance of the third-party candidates, at least the ones that are left now that No Labels is out?
I think it could be very serious. And I think that Robert Kennedy is a very serious candidate. Happily, he's not on the ballot in most places right now, but very serious tug for younger voters, a very serious tug for the people who don't like either candidate and wish they had a different choice. And they are attributing to Robert Kennedy Jr. a lot of his father and uncle's positions, which he does not have. And they're also liking, young people like him because he's, quote unquote, an environmental lawyer. So I think it's serious. And his VP candidate allows him to have access to some pretty significant resources. So I think it's serious. I think we need to get Robert Kennedy defined. What's really revealing here is in the primary states where he was originally visible, Democrats were initially net favorable toward him and turned net negative because they found out about some of his positions, which were not very popular, and some of his inconsistencies, which just seem weird to people. I think they're serious. I think that he's got to get defined, and I think we'll have to watch and see how many ballots he actually gets on.
So, Linda Legge, always a pleasure to talk with you to discuss the realities of perception and what voters are thinking.
Thank you so much, and great questions, and great to be on your show.
We have two Trump outrages this week. First, the new Trump family-operated Republican National Committee lies. A new fundraising robocall unveiled last week is built around the big lie, Trump's claims that the 2020 election was stolen, something that's been proven time and again in court cases nationwide to be total BS. But that isn't stopping the RNC.
Oh, hello. I'm Stephanie calling for the Republican National Committee co-chair Lara Trump and the election security staff at the Republican National Committee on a recorded line. This is very important and I won't take up a lot of your time. But first, we want to thank you for your generous past support. And I'm sure you agree with co-chair Trump that we cannot allow the chaos and questions of the 2020 election to ever happen again. We all know the problems. No photo IDs, unsecured ballot drop boxes, mass mailing of ballots and voter rolls chock full of deceased people and non-citizens are just a few examples of the massive fraud that took place. And it's pretty clear that the radical Democrat bureaucrats and politicians will do whatever it takes to ensure their fellow Democrats get elected. We cannot let this happen. If Democrats have their way, your vote could be canceled out by someone who isn't even an American citizen. Patriots like you, the people who actually pull the wagon in this country, deserve nothing less than free and fair election. That's what separates our great nation from a third world dictatorship.
The big lie was the fuel for the fire that ignited the January 6th insurrection, and it's at the heart of the two criminal cases against Donald Trump. It is appalling that a once proud national party continues to fan the flames 4 years later. Second, Trump's blatant racism. Speaking in a private fundraiser populated by his billionaire buddies, Trump revealed his true feelings about immigration and racism. The New York Times' Maggie Hagerman reported that Trump lamented that people were not immigrating to the U.S. from, quote, nice countries like Denmark, end quote, and suggested that his well-heeled dinner companions were temporarily safe from an undocumented immigrant nearby, according to an attendee. It was part of a 45-minute rant at the palatial Palm Beach home of billionaire John Paulson. About midway through his remarks, Hagerman reports, Trump began an extensive rant about migrants entering the U.S. Quote, these are people coming in from prisons and jails. They're coming in from just unbelievable places and countries, countries that are a disaster, Trump told his guests, according to the attendee. The former president has made a similar claim at the heart of his campaign speeches. He then appeared to refer to an episode during his presidency when he drew significant criticism after an Oval Office meeting with federal lawmakers about immigration, during which he described Haiti and some nations in Africa as, quote, shithole countries, end quote, compared with places like Norway. Quote, and when I said, you know, why can't we allow people to come in from nice countries? I'm trying to be nice, Mr. Trump said at the dinner, to chuckles from the crowd. Quote, nice countries, you know, like Denmark, Switzerland. Do we have any people coming from Denmark? How about Switzerland? How about Norway? End quote. In other words, let's limit immigration to white Europeans. Ironically, he left out Slovenia, the birthplace of his current wife, who was seated right next to him during the diatribe. And a reminder for Democrats in Southeast Michigan, there are two important elections on Tuesday. At stake is restoring our majority in the Michigan House of Representatives. We have two outstanding candidates, Mai Song in the Warren area's 13th House District and Peter Herzberg in the Westland area's 25th House District. Every vote matters in races that could be very close. That's this week's report from your Michigan Democratic Party. I'm Lavoie Barnes. Thank you for listening.
Paid for by the Michigan Democratic Party, 606 Townsend, Lansing, Michigan, 48933.